Being the smartest one in the room has a terrible ROI. There's virtually zero upside. There's massive downside. And so those that continue to stay in that learning mode, the successful people that outlearn everyone else, it almost makes this a harmonious flywheel. The more you learn, the better off you're going to be able to prepare. The more prepared you are, the better that you're going to be able to produce and find leverage. And the more that you continue to learn makes the flywheel spin faster.
In her book, Conversational Intelligence, Judith Glasser wrote, "To get to the next level of greatness depends on the quality of our culture, which depends on the quality of our relationships, which depends on the quality of our conversations. Everything happens through conversations." Welcome to Conversations, powered by Quantivos. Welcome to this episode of Conversations. I'm Brian Gorman, your host and a coach here at Quantivos. And our guest today is Aaron Trahan, founder of Performance Mindset Coaching. Welcome, Aaron.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm excited for this conversation.
So we have a, I would say, unique title for this particular episode that comes from the work that you're doing and does not align very well with a sports metaphor, if you will. Three outs for the win. Where did you ever come up with the idea that outs lead you to a win?
You know, I wish I could say that this was like the brainchild, the inspiration from the very beginning, but I kind of fell into it. And, you know, the origin story here is really dating back to whenever I was an intern. You know, really at the very start of my career, I started to notice a difference with leaders who continued to find newer, higher levels of success and those that seemed to kind of plateau out, that they would reach a certain level and kind of hit a wall. And that's what really, for me, started to go on this, for lack of a better term, investigative journey to find out, what is this group of people doing that continue to help them find new level after new level that this other group just is not doing? And for my own personal benefit, I kind of thought, if I could distill this down into a formula, an equation, something that I can use for myself, I can check these three boxes or however many boxes in a given day that would dramatically increase the probability of my own success. Well, hell, that's a better hack than any other, right? So let's figure out what that is. And, you know, after years and years and years, I wish I could say that this was a short, simple process, but this basically culminated over a good part of a decade. Three things really kept showing up for me. And it was three things that this group did in terms of outperformance from everybody else that was around them. And that's where it just kind of, it clicked to me one day. It's like, yeah, three things that they're doing to outperform. This is a simple three out formula, kind of playing on a baseball term here. And it's like, that worked out pretty well. So I wish it was more of a ground up thing versus it just kind of being like, this kind of fits together after it was already complete.
So, Aaron, how about giving us what the three outs are, and then let's dive into exploring them together?
Yeah, absolutely, Brian. Great idea. So really, when you look at the common threads that separated the group of professionals that continue to find new level after new level versus the ones that don't, really boiled down to them doing three things at a greater level or more impactful level than everyone else around them. Number one, they outprepared all of their peer group. Number two, they outworked everyone around them. And number three, they outlearned everyone around them. That kind of became the core three things that were kind of the universal truth. They kept emerging time and time again that kind of drove the aggregation of this formula.
So let's start with outprepare. How do you outprepare as a leader?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. As a leader, when you think about preparation, as a wise man put it to me, is if you're not prepared for worst case scenario, or if things, you know, what it looks like when things completely fall apart, you're not really prepared. But the downside of that is there's a hell of a lot of work that goes into always ensuring that your I's are always dotted, your T's are always crossed. And when I think about out preparing, these were just the people that just operated with a standard of excellence that whenever they showed up fully prepared, fully aware, fully present. If they made a mistake, it wasn't going to be due to lack of preparation. They always did their homework. They always did their due diligence, and they always protected themselves against what I kind of call a downfall to success, is that when we have some success, we're feeling good about where we're at, preparation is always the thing in our quest to gain more time that we kind of start shaving off, right? Is success can breed complacency and or big ego. And with enough success, you start kind of believing that you don't need to prepare as much. You can just kind of show up. Your experience will carry you. You may be able to just wing it and come up with a solution on the fly. And it always turned out to be a big mistake. And so this outperformance group never took that for granted. They may be the most successful one in the room, but they're usually the ones that prepared the most coming in before a big meeting, presentation, whatever it may be. So that's how I kind of really encapsulate what out-preparing looks like.
4 decades ago, I knew nothing about neuroscience. I'm not sure I even knew how to spell it. And I was in a fairly early part of my career. And I remember reading an article. I want to say it was the New York Times, but it's a long time ago. But it said, if you as a leader prepare for the worst thing that can happen, you're prepared for anything else as well. And, you know, that really echoes what you're talking about. And I believe there is neuroscience behind that, because our brain, our unconscious, filters out so much of the information that comes to us. And if I spend some time thinking about what is the worst thing that can happen, how might that show up? What might be some of the signs that, you know, there's crisis ahead or there's a roadblock ahead or whatever. It's not that I'm going to sit there and plan to make it happen. I don't even necessarily have to sit there and plan everything I'm going to do if it does happen. But now I have sort of retuned my unconscious filters to make me aware if it's showing up on the horizon. So I really like that piece of it, but I also really resonate with what you're saying about how we can get comfortable where we are and just feel like I'm in the groove, I've got this going, I'll show up tomorrow and everything will be okay, because life doesn't work that way.
No, and then, you know, something that you said too, you just hit on a very, very important point, is look at the environment around us, whether it be macro environments, the business environment, everything is changing at an acceleratingly fast rate. And so when you're not prepared, you're not going through all the steps, especially for the worst case scenario, the downside, you're going to find yourself being pretty static, pretty on your heels, because everything around us is moving quickly. What preparation, another hidden benefit of what it allows, is it allows you to be more flexible, more adaptable, more agile to the inevitable changes and curveballs that are going to get thrown your way. Nothing is an up and to the right kind of linear progression. So what preparation does is allows you to pivot when you need to pivot, to adapt when you need to adapt, because you've done your homework. You're more able to make those moves, those pivots, those adjustments on an as-needed basis. And it just keeps you, for lack of a better term, future-proof. You're always going to be in a position to essentially be ready for whatever the world throws at you.
So outwork, that means our workaholic tendencies are a good thing, right?
Not so much. So this is a good one to unpack. And for simplicity, I like to use outwork because there is meaning behind that. And look, all great things do come from hard work. But when we're thinking about outworking everyone else around us, it is not some hustle culture speak where, you know, this alpha male environment. Everyone's walking around with kind of a badge of honor on their arm of how many hours they logged, you know, last week. That's not what it's about. When I think we've all been guilty of, whether it's, you know, job interviews or whatever it is when we're asked the question, well, what separates you from everybody else? And, oh, I'm the hardest worker. I'm going to outwork everybody, blah, blah, blah. At some point, you get to a level where you look around and guess what? Everybody's a high performer. Everybody's a hard worker. It's not the differentiator. It's going to be just the rent that's due to be in that room. What this group found is they realize we all only have 24 hours a day, 7 days in a week, 12 months in a year. Time is a level playing field for all of us. So when you can harness your energy, your effort, your focus on the things that are most priority, highest priority, you gain leverage. And the not so secret secret is that for any professional leader or executive who can find leverage in creating that spread between their inputs and their outputs, they're always going to win. You can almost kind of think about this as the game being rigged. And those who find the most leverage on their time, energy, focus, and output will always outperform those that don't, who are just trying to figure out ways of how can I work 80 hours in a week versus 75 or 90 hours a week versus 80. That's not sustainable. But leverage and high productivity can be. So that's what I mean when we kind of get to the second out, which is outworking everyone around.
It makes me think of what's sometimes referred to as the Covey time or time management matrix. Sometimes it's referred to as the Eisenhower matrix. And
love that.
And for me, time management is a fallacy. As you said, we all have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's about managing priorities. And for those who aren't familiar with the matrix, think of a 2x2 table, if you will. And across the top, I always put importance. And on the vertical, I put urgency. And so many of us drive that urgency lane. And the urgency lane goes from important and urgent to unimportant and urgent. And so we're not maximizing the use of our time when we're focusing on the unimportant. So to outwork means driving the important lane, making time for those things that are important but not urgent.
Yeah, that's so well said. I'm a huge fan of the Eisenhower matrix, because if you leave your capability to effectively prioritize up to randomness, you're in trouble. We all need tools. We all need systems. We all need filtering mechanisms to understand, oh, and guess what? The more successful you become, the more opportunities that are going to flow your way. And sometimes distractions are just disguised as easy opportunities. And so if you don't have a mechanism to, as I believe this was a Dale Carnegie statement, is the most important thing is keeping the most important thing the most important thing. So if you don't have a system to be able to help you do that, you're going to be at the whim of the latest and greatest shiny object that is battling for your attention and focus. And if you pick up your phone, what sits on the other side of many of those apps is some of the smartest engineers on the planet who are hardwiring algorithms to drive your attention away from what the priorities are. And so it really is as simple as that. If everything's a priority, then nothing's a priority. What this group does to outwork or outproduce everyone around them is harness as much of their prime focus, attention, energy, and effort on the absolute most important things. And that's where the spread comes in. From the impact of your outputs, from your inputs will show up. And that's how you get leverage. That's how you're able to scale you.
Outlearn.
Ooh, the big one. I would almost go as far as saying that this is the most important one of the three. And here's the reason why. I think when you are a lifelong learner, it is the only guaranteed sustainable competitive advantage that I know of. When you're in a learning mode and stay in learning mode, everything is going to be fixable or solvable. And this is what I see. This is the biggest trap of successful leaders, is when they rise up the ranks, they really forget to stay in learning. They have a natural tendency to want to leverage their success. They feel validated. They kind of probably have an ego to come with it now. They want to be dishing out the guidance and dishing out the advice. It's not easy staying in learning mode, but a little secret that, again, is not so big of a secret is being the smartest one in the room has a terrible ROI. There's virtually zero upside. There's massive downside. And so those that continue to stay in that learning mode, the successful people that outlearn everyone else, it almost makes this a harmonious flywheel. The more you learn, the better off you're going to be able to prepare. The more prepared you are, the better that you're going to be able to produce and find leverage. And the more that you continue to learn makes the flywheel spin faster. But this, and largely because of the ego and probably a combination of the comfort zone, is, you know, learning's not sexy. It's not always comfortable. When we're learning, we're kind of, you know, we're afraid for others to look at us when we're sucking at something or we're going up the learning curve. So when we're successful, it's usually the easiest thing to unplug because we're already successful, right? And so it's without even knowing it, we stop learning and we're just using our past, our resume, yesterday's newspaper, so to speak, to make all future decisions. But learning and staying in learning mode is such a critical component to next level success.
There's a number of things I want to explore here. I don't even know who has said this to me, and I know I've heard it over and over and over again. One of the greatest skills we can develop in the world today is to unlearn and relearn. One of the things I love about hosting this podcast is I have to keep learning. I have to keep challenging how I see the world and learning to see it through the eyes of others and learn what they've learned. Did a podcast a while ago with Nancy Napier out of Boise, Idaho, and Nancy wrote a book called Wise Beyond Your Field. And she had created what the group called themselves the Gang. And it was Nancy. It was the Boise State football coach. It was the founder of a software company. It was the county sheriff and leaders out of the arts. And one of them said, if I am leading my company according to the best practices in my industry, everybody in my industry is going for those best practices. What makes me competitive? I need to learn beyond my field. I need to learn from others. The other thing, and this brings to mind a couple of things that you said earlier in this conversation, the world keeps changing. If I knew everything, if I was bringing today to the challenges of, let's say, leading organizational change, all that I learned back in the late 1980s about organizational change, I would be a miserable failure. Not that anything that I learned back then was wrong. It was state of the art, but our understanding of the human psychology of change, our understanding of the neuroscience of change, and the way in which the culture has changed in organizations and broader society, I need to keep learning or I can't keep up. I know people who have retired and have sort of said, I'm out of the rat race. I can sit back and put my feet up. The challenge is the world doesn't stop because you retire. And so you become more and more disconnected if you're not still learning.
I would also go as far as saying, too, that your cognitive performance is no different than any other muscle. When you stop using it, you start losing it. You know, an interesting longevity study, too, that speaks to this is, I'm sure you've heard of the concept of the blue zone. There's these different places across the world where there's astronomically higher percentage on, you know, per 100 people who lived over 100. And I was researching one of them in Okinawa in Japan, and astronomically high, you know, per capita, you know, population of people living over 100, you know, they don't even have a word in Japanese for retirement. It's not even really a thing that's kind of talked about. Sure, they may leave their corporate role or function, but they develop new purposes and new passions. They're up first thing in the morning, either tending to a garden or providing community service, but there's something that continues to get them learning, something that gives them purpose, something that kind of fuels the cognitive bandwidth that they have. And there's no surprise that they have no concept of sitting back, putting their feet up and quote unquote retiring. It's just they transition to a different hobby, passion, purpose that allows them to stay in a learning mode that keeps them mentally youthful. That's now showing up in all kinds of longevity studies on just how to live a high quality, long life. I found that pretty interesting.
Before I hit record, you said that there may be a fourth out that you're beginning to dig into. Any hints?
Yeah. So I'm always stress testing some of my concepts. And one of the things I keep coming back to, and I think we talked a little bit about it in the outwork section, but I'm starting to believe that this warrants its own fourth out, and it comes down to focus and the ability to say no to things. Warren Buffett has a great quote that the one thing that has always separated successful people from average people, and this also goes to companies, but successful people and companies say no to almost everything. And it's not because they have a bias for saying no, it's that they're so focused on what they deem to be the priority or the main thing. And that's where it's more of a harnessing mechanism. Because if you think about being prepared, you think about outworking, you think about outlearning, the big Achilles heel is poor quality focus. That's the one thing that could bring down the entire house of cards, that if you can't harness your focus on those most important things, develop the ability to say no to non-priorities, and then when you're focused on something, it's not about putting in all the hours, but it's almost being very intense, deliberate, or have intention with where your focus goes. And I think if your focus is fractured, that will show up in performance. When you can laser in and have as much or as close to 100% of your focus on a given task, initiative, or project, it will always, without fail, show up in the quality of work. And so I think that's kind of one of the things I'm thinking about teasing out, playing with. And if I do, you've heard it here first. This is where the fourth out's going to come from, and it is around focus.
One of the characteristics of Steve Jobs that made Apple successful was his ability to say no to some incredibly good ideas so that they could focus on the few. One of my favorite books, and I am often referring it to clients, is Greg McKeown's Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And Greg makes the point, we are culturally trained, if you will, to say yes, to not disappoint. And yet we say yes to so much that we can't fully live into most, if not all, of those yeses. And so by saying no to those things that are not essential, whether it be essential to us professionally, essential to the organizations that we're serving, the clients we're serving, or even in our personal lives, if we're not able to say no, we're not able to be fully present with the yeses that are essential.
That's so well said. And look, here's the truth. Focus gets tougher the higher up the food chain you go. And you're going to have just flat out more opportunities, more temptations, more things pulling at you when you're at the CEO level than when you were at the bottom of the hierarchy, because you demonstrated capability, demonstrated skill. More people are going to want your time, attention, focus. And so this is something that becomes more important, not less, the more successful you become. It's easy to kind of climb up the mountain and reach the top one time, but it's exceptionally more difficult to stay there. It's why you hear over and over again, teams talk about repeating as Super Bowl champions was a hell of a lot harder than winning it the first time. You see this in combat sports. What happens after these new champions win the belt? They typically don't hang on to it very long. They left their foot off the accelerator. They're now the world champion. You've got endorsement deals. You've got all kinds of distractions. They lost focus on what got them there to begin with. And so it plays out all over life. And that's why I think it's more important, even as the more successful you become, for you to be able to out focus those around you to keep the most important thing the most important thing.
We got to wrap up. Any last thoughts to share with our listeners?
No, other than I think there's just no substitute for taking action, right? There's always going to be reasons not to. The uncertainty of risk, the fear of failure, whatever it may be. But the message that I would give to the audience is everything that we've talked about today requires action. Ideas are easy, execution's everything, and execution doesn't happen when you're standing still. So overcome that fear of failure, overcome the risk, overcome the uncertainty. There's usually magic that sits on the other side of the actions that you may be temporarily avoiding.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.